Welcome to The Hobcast, a weekly podcast from Hoback Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of building a new creative business in this pandemic world. We'll hear from the people who make all this possible, the authors, cover designers, and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on The Hobcast from Hoback Books, as we combined trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello.
And welcome to the latest edition of The Hobcast Book Show, which happens to be our 50th.
It is our 50th, and it is the last of 2021 as we record, but it'll be the first of 2022.
And we are out and about again, and we've gone on a sort of mid between Christmas and New Year's, New Year's Eve as we speak, trip to Oxford.
I was saying this the other day, we very rarely go anywhere for New Year's Eve. We seem to go somewhere either just before or just after. So this is our just before New Year's Eve trip. We were out last night. We went to a place called Yateley in Hampshire.
Yeah. It was it was a sort of gathering of old friends, and that was lovely. And but we have some news. Let's get that done first, because we're not talking about publishing news.
This wasn't in the bookseller.
This wasn't in the bookseller. It should be, and one day it will be.
I would love that to be in the bookseller. But anyway,
we have some personal news. On Christmas Day, which, as everyone who listens to this podcast knows, was also Rebecca's 50th birthday, I somehow managed to get down on one knee and propose, and very graciously, you have accepted.
I did.
And we are engaged.
We are. I mean, not straight away, because I was just looking at you down on your knee thinking, I don't know what I was thinking. And I have a ring, but it's made out of paper. It's a very beautifully created origami ring.
Yeah, which I knocked up the morning of the occasion. There will be a proper ring, and don't worry, we'll share it on social media. But that is to come. But we're outside the Bodleian Library, where a number of Hoback Books now reside.
That's very true. There are some of our books are actually in this building.
It's wonderful, isn't it? And a whole load more have just winged their way towards the copyright libraries of the UK.
Actually, they went to the British Library in Boston.
Oh, yeah, well, that's their receipt. But then they distribute them.
There's only one of each.
Oh, okay.
So
right.
I think the system is, just to explain to people, that we have to give 6 copies of all the books we publish. They go to a central location, and then those ones are distributed to all the what they're called,
copyright libraries.
Yes, so there's various locations in the UK, and then the British Library is actually, for some reason, you send that copy separately.
So all of our publications eventually end up here, in the Bodleian,
so
in Cambridge University Library.
There.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's wonderful. And we're in what's known as Radcliffe Square, with the Radcliffe Camera in front of us, which is one of the signature buildings of Oxford. I mean, I didn't study here, and I haven't lived here. A lot of my friends did go here.
And
actually, I've got an update. I want to just break in with an update. So for those of you who remember a previous episode where I described how... in our last episode, actually, if I had a chance to do some childish games, we'd play war again. And the poor fate of my old friend Duncan Richards, who fell when I shouted grenade, threw himself flat on the ground, not knowing that there was an enormous dog poo that landed right underneath him under his chest. Anyway, it turns out Duncan Richards is now a professor here at Oxford University.
We might even walk past him today.
Yeah, we might. Yeah,
Wouldn't it be funny if you bumped into him?
He still has a very prominent chin. God, I'm really selling him. But anyway, look, congratulations, Duncan. I knew you'd end up being something, because I used to crib your physics homework. Big time. I used to pay you for the privilege. So you had a nice little earner going.
Well, I actually lived here for about 15 years, or lived close to Oxford. So Oxford was my main, it was where we went shopping, where we went to town for a long time. But I've forgotten so much about where everything is. Frustrating for you.
That was very evident. I mean, I knew more about it than you did, so which is hilarious. But anyway, we are in Oxford, and we're feeling a wonderful vibe. It's very spring-like. Beautiful sunshine low over the tower of Brasenose College, And the Radcliffe camera with the body, and I'm actually leaning
against
the ancient stones, yeah, which is terrible, really. But it is, yeah, I mean, Oxford in this sort of light, bright
beautiful.
Blue skies is absolutely stunning.
I mean, that's what I loved about living here is it always looked beautiful, whatever the weather, the time of year. It always had a sort of a sense of, well, the sense of history, obviously, but the sense of knowledge and...
Yeah. And no, it's otherworldly, and it is quite inspiring. Anyway, now, normally, we also introduced ourselves properly, really. So, I'm Adrian Hobart. I'm now engaged to...
Rebecca Collins. So, I'm now engaged to you.
Yeah, that's right. And together, in all respects, we now run Hobeck Books, which is a UK independent publisher of the following genres.
Thrillers.
Crime.
Mystery.
And suspense.
I would just like to tell a little story about the engagement. A few days ago I went to get my booster jab, and when you go to get your booster jab you get registered by various people. There's about four different people you talk to and they all ask you your date of birth, and the one woman said, when I said 25th of the 12th, she said, oh, you've just had a birthday, happy birthday. And she asked me, did you have any special presents? So I said, well, I did have one special present I was proposed to. And she looked at my finger and I said, no, I haven't got a ring yet. And she said, what will you be? And I said, I'll be a Hobart. And she said, oh, how posh.
Yeah, I say, yeah. And well, it's not going to be that posh. Now, for those of you marking the date, keep it free for 2 years' time. The 21st of December, 2023. We decided this some time ago before I actually proposed. So we're sticking to it, the winter solstice.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it because it's less... You know, it's more usual to have a wedding in the sort of spring, summer, autumn,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, my last one was September, so I'm looking forward to December.
It's going
to
be an interesting one. Anyway, we're not going to look at publishing news this week because there hasn't really, frankly, been a lot out there.
No, they've all been on holiday, so...
No. I mean, the one thing I noted was, you remember our bookshop discussions where they were saying the only time they ever sell hardbacks... That really is annoying, that little lad playing with the bell on a bicycle. He's getting told off now. He'll give up in a second. But basically, the hardbacks only sell at Christmas time in most of the bookshops that we've spoken to. Waterstones were doing a massive sale, 50% off all hardbacks.
Now, that's interesting, because Waterstones rarely do that sort of sale.
Yeah, in their stores to try and get rid of all these things.
Now, that's telling.
Yeah, it is telling. Anyway, that's anecdotal and something I noticed. But we're not going to do it because this 50th edition, we haven't got any specific guests this week either. So it's a little different. It's an opportunity for us to reflect on the year past and the first 50 shows of the Hobcast, and also to look ahead to what's to come for the company and for our authors and for everybody who works with us. And also, of course, you know, some thoughts about what we're going to do with the Hobcast. But... number one, we wanted to reflect on the year of achievement. I mean, it sometimes doesn't feel like it, especially, you know, if sales are sluggish or things haven't quite worked out to the extent that we hoped. But nonetheless, we've done incredible things. I mean, we've built a company. So that in itself is a massive achievement. We've also attracted 17 authors to join us.
Yeah, because we'd only published the books of two authors this time last year.
That's right.
I mean, we had a few in the pipeline, but to go from, so Robert Dawes and Lewis Hastings were the first two that we published Lewis towards the end of last year.
Mm.
And it's phenomenal, really, what we've done since then. We've gathered, you know, a lovely team of authors, and I can't remember how many books we've published, but...
Yeah, so it's over 30 books. So, I mean, you know, from a standing start, it's impressive. Anyway, we thought we'd first of all reflect on some of the conversations we had with Hobeck authors. I will start, if we may, with our first-timers. And the key question we asked all of them, how does it feel to finally become a published author? Anthony Dunford, published author. How does that feel?
It feels mostly pretty good, but it's been a little bit nerve-wracking as well. But no, it's wonderful. It's a dream come true of many years, I think. And I've got a pile of books next to me, 16 of them, all with my name on them.
Wendy Turbin.
I am completely over the moon. I have been skipping around like a spring lamb, and I'm not a spring lamb. So, you know, just saying. This is so exciting. It's a lifetime ambition for me to have a book out there in print, being read by ebook, by other people who don't know me. This is very exciting. I'm immensely grateful.
Mark Whiteman.
For some reason, I've never really been able to fully understand that urge to write, that urge to be a writer, never left me. And it would keep sort of bubbling out every 2 or 3 years quite strongly. Even though I didn't write, you know, you speak to other people who are writers and they've always written something. I didn't, but I had this really deep rooted need almost, I guess, to be a writer one day. So as I say, it took an awful long time to actually come to fruition and to come to doing it, but it's been with me all my life.
Well, not only have we launched the careers, the publishing careers of certain of our authors, a number of them, we've also attracted people who've been around the block a tiny bit.
I don't know if they'd like to be described.
More experienced authors who've got a few books under their belts, and we've been very privileged to have them join us and bring their experience and their wisdom as well.
I think the interesting point to make here is that they've taught us a lot.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think the thing we try and stay as if open to learning.
Oh, we are always open to learning. I mean, that's my philosophy in everything, not just in the work I do, but in life. And I was saying this, I think it was over Christmas, to my sister's family, that you never stop learning. You might not think you're learning sometimes, but you really are. You never stop learning.
Yeah, well, you learn from the mistakes and you learn from the good things and what works and what doesn't. But nonetheless, we've drawn a lot of strength from our experienced authors. And so let's hear from some of them.
Linda Huber.
So go on, give us an honest review. How does a Hoback book differ from anything else you've had published?
That is a very difficult question. And the thing that springs to mind first is it's orangey-yellow colour on the cover image. I've never had an orange book before, so it stands out in my bookcase. Apart from that, it is just doing the same procedure with different people. You know, you go through the editing process and the proofing process and approving the cover image. And it is the same for every book, I think.
So,
yeah. And in a way, the one that you're working on at the moment is always the special one.
Malcolm Hollingdrake.
The idea of creating new characters inspired in a way. I was asked at one time, I was commissioned to write a new series. And I had the idea for the two lady detectives, Skeeter and April. Originally, I thought of bringing April Richmond from the Harrogate series to Merseyside, but then thought better of it. But I had Skeeter in my mind for quite some time. And because Wigan is well known for its wrestling and catch-as-catch-can wrestling at the Snake Pit, I wanted her to be a candidate. So I went and did the research with a gentleman called Royce Banks, who has a gym at Ince in Wigan and a very keen wrestler himself, and I spent a couple of hours with him talking about it, so it seemed to fit perfectly. And and once I got into the writing of the Harrogate, the difficulty is not confusing one series with another, because Catch as Catch Can is, I've written three books since Catch as Catch Can, so you do forget where you are. And I'm writing book 11 of the Harrogate at the present time, and I have to really think carefully about who's what, who are the police, who are the team, to make sure I don't duplicate from one to the other. But I've loved it. I've loved every minute, and I hope it comes through that I do love Liverpool. So to be able to write along the Sefton coast is just ideal for me.
Ollie Jarvis.
When I started writing, I would get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and try and do a couple of hours before court, and it was very, very hard, nearly killed me, in fact. And so now what I do is I book blocks out, and I have very understanding clerks, and I try and book blocks out and try and write maybe 30,000 words in that block. And if you're writing every day, you can move faster as well. If you can get 1,000 words done every day, I find that things can move on much quicker if I have a period of time where I don't have to think about work. But one of the things that I learned from the Genesis Inquiry, talking about realizing what's important and reconnecting, I realized that I'd written this book all about camper vans, And that was because I didn't have a camper van. So we've just gone out and got ourselves a camper van. So
wonderful.
I've got more time in my little tiny camper van with my family.
A.B. Morgan.
Depends also what type of fiction writer you are. And by that, I mean, are you someone like Frederick Forsyth who plots everything out to the nth degree and knows exactly what's going to happen in each paragraph, in each chapter, every single part of the story is accounted for before it's then written? Or are you a pantser? Do you fly by the seat of your pants, have a rough idea of a story or even an ending, and then create your story to get to that ending? And I'm a bit of both. I'm a plotty pantser, which sounds like a small child. Yeah, it sounds like a small child having a nasty accident, doesn't it?
Now, the Hopcast Book Show has, you know, we're new on the block in the podcasting terms, and we're really gratified with the audience that we've already built. But, you know, there are times when you approach people and you know, they'll give us a fob off, but that hasn't really happened that often.
No.
And we're really gratified by the number of big names that have spoken to us over the last year, some of them at festivals, but sometimes away from that. And we were gobsmacked when we started sitting opposite, as we did in Harrogate, the great Ian Rankin.
That was definitely one of the highlights of my year.
Yeah, I mean, you just pinch yourself. I mean, this guy is the godfather of British crime writing right now, and has done so much for the industry as a, you know, in a wider sense. And also, you know, it's very, very sort of looks out for the little guy, as we've discovered. But great to speak to him. And let's hear from some of the big names that we've chatted to over the last year.
Well, in some ways, it was a blessed relief. It was like an escape tunnel out of camp pandemic. I could sit in my little room in Edinburgh, not really allowed to go out for more than an hour a day, do no socialising, etc., etc. And I could just immerse myself in a kind of a simpler world, a world with no cell phones, no mobile phones, no DNA analysis, no computers in police stations, you know, all that stuff, which, you know, is a curse for the contemporary crime writer, because you go, well, I need to remember, I've got to deal with a mobile phone. If somebody's getting kidnapped, why don't they just phone the police, you know? you make sure the mobile phone hasn't got a signal, or they run out of battery, all these things you have to, sort of, you know, or the CCTV. So if someone's attacked in the street, has any CCTV picked up? None of that was an issue. It was a much simpler world. And Laidlaw, the detective, operates through a series of informers, snitches, grassies. What's now called human intelligence, or covert human intelligence, and that's what he does. He knows Glasgow. He knows the streets of Glasgow like the back of his hand. He goes out. He goes on buses and travels everywhere by bus, because he gets a sense of the city as he's travelling through it. He goes into pubs and talks to people, and he starts to piece together what the city is all about and what secrets people are keeping from him.
Almost like a jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah, almost like a jigsaw puzzle, and detective novels really are that. They are you start with a puzzle and you start to put pieces in place and you solve it. I did a lot more planning for this book than I would normally do for one of my books. I'm famously a pantser. I don't do a lot of planning.
Ask, yeah.
I make it up as I go along. But with this, because Willie had left notes, I had something to work from. And I knew that I needed, before I started writing that, I needed to kind of work out in my own head what was going on, what did he think was going on in his book. So all of that took some time, but it's, you know, it's mercifully quite a short book. These days, I think a lot of novels are overblown. They're just, you know, because of the onset of the computer, we novelists are given free rein. We don't have to, when you were using a typewriter, let me tell you, especially a portable typewriter, a manual portable typewriter, whatever, you were very careful not to make too many mistakes, because you knew how hard it was going to be to correct all that. Cutting and pasting was a real thing.
When I started in journalism, it was still typewriters.
Oh, yeah. Still, you know, proper cutting and pasting.
Yeah.
And these days, it's too easy just to keep on writing. And sort of crime novels now are 400, 500, 600 pages, even longer.
Yeah, it's like almost like the expectation has changed as well, that people expect them to be bigger than they used to be.
Well, you know what? When I was early on in my career, someone told me, and I forget if it was a publisher or an agent, they said, if you want to be taken seriously as a writer, not just as a crime writer, you better write books over 300 pages. Because if it's under 300, it's just a whodunit.
Oh.
Right.
Right. You know, the kind of Agatha Christie style book.
Yeah, yeah.
Or the early Ruth Rendles. They're just whodunits. And if you're taken seriously because you think you're taking on big themes and maybe some politics and everything else, then you need to write longer books.
Mark Billingham.
You know, I had a very special night here on Thursday where I got the Outstanding Contribution Award, which there's always a little part voice in the back of your head going, does that award really mean, all right, mate, you've had your time.
Yeah.
here's a nice prize now. Just go away, mate, room for somebody else.
And, you know, yeah, 20 minutes later.
20 minutes later, you got one. But that same week, in fact, that same day, my new book came out, which is the most different, for me, thing I've ever done. You know, it's a standalone book in a first person, and I've never written a book like it. So that's a long way of saying, yes, you have to. You have to do something different. If you'll just keep turning out the same book every year, readers are very quickly going to go, no, that's going to be stale.
And what about that experience of writing in the first person and changing the, you know, because I've struggled with flipping between first person and omniscient and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, no, I loved it. I mean, I've always done a bit of first person in every book, but to do a whole book, it's a challenge because you're asking the reader to spend 400 pages inside the head of, you know, one voice.
And also you have to be in the head of that one voice too.
Which is hard enough. And you make it somebody that's very different to you, in this case, a kind of young northern woman, nothing like me. But I loved it, and I wrote it really quickly. I think you write quicker in the first person. You definitely just get more words out in a day.
Yeah.
Sort of stream of consciousness thing, but no, I really, really loved it. I'm really proud of it. Next year will be a very different book. Back to Tom Thorne. I've already written that book, and the year after that, hopefully, you know, something different, a nice slim volume of poetry, perhaps.
Abir Mukherjee.
I think a lot of authors feel this way. I know I've read Ian Rankin say that if you could go back, you would rewrite Noughts and Crosses. I know Joseph Knox, who wrote The Smiling Man and Sirens. And books like that, he's actually gone back and rewritten his first book, which is, you know what, he's much more efficient, much more organized, and much more talented than I am. The idea of going back and fixing my book would take too long. It's true. I find it very difficult to read that first book, especially the first half of it. It was very much the beginning of a journey, and it's a journey I'm still on. I think there will come a point where, well, I would hope there would come a point where, you know, if I read this new book, I won't be able to read it. If I read it in 10 years' time, I'll still cringe because I hope that I'll have learned more. But yeah, each book is different. I feel I'm learning with each book, but I'm still so close to the bottom of the mountain that, you know, I'm not going to run out of cringe anytime soon.
Too posh to push on cobbles. We're just being asked to get out of the way of a buggy.
Ooh, I used to push on cobbles because it sent them to sleep.
Yeah. Anyway, well, you know, oh dear, they've got to go on cobbles now. They've got no choice. Anyway, you know, us roadblockers in the biggest square in Oxford, honestly. But we've also had the opportunity to speak to some of the new stars of the British crime writing scene. I'm talking about the indie authors who've taken the plunge, published themselves, and built a massive following. And two people in mind particularly stand out. I think Simon McCleave, from a standing start beginning of last year in 2021, wasn't it, when he launched? It's incredible what he's achieved in terms of selling as many books as he has. He's sold over 1 million now. And we've also spoken in similar vein to one of his close friends, Jason Dalgleish, who's also done incredible numbers.
Yes, and I think Jason Dalgleish was the lucky first recipient of Rebecca's random question.
I'll make sure that we get to hear that one in a moment. Let's hear from those guys.
Simon McCleave.
I actually made a decision not to release a book for a year, and I thought what I'm going to do is I'm going to write the first three, and I'm going to spend a whole year while I'm still sort of teaching, but kind of reading and reading and listening and doing everything I can on indie publishing. So I listened to every audiobook, podcast, and read everything I could find for a year. So I completely immersed it. I did the Mark Dawson's courses, I did Nick Stevenson courses, I read books by Chris Fox and Joe Penn and listened to everything I could do and kind of like did it like a mini degree in self-publishing.
Shame you haven't got the certificate.
I know, but I just thought, if I'm going to do this, I want to do this right with as much knowledge about this as I can get. And, you know, the rapid release stuff seems to work. I don't want to put a book out there and then spend 6 months writing the next one while people forget who I am. So I did. I released the first three books in 3 months because I just thought, well, that at least that gives me a little bit of a kind of
momentum and
momentum. Then, and you know, and if people are buying the third book, then I'm thinking that the fourth book is going to be worth. You know, it's you can drive people to your first book, but what you can't do is make them buy the second one. So you can probably get sales of your first book. Just through very clever marketing and, you know, spending a lot of money on Facebook and Amazon, you can actually sell them. But to get people to then buy the second and then the third, you have to write decent books because no one's going to carry on buying them. So for me, it was like, well, if they continue to buy the series, then I know that I'm doing something that's okay.
Jason Dalgleish.
I didn't have any history of writing, publishing fiction, nothing at all. So I came at it just with, I'll write a book. I had no idea about structure. I hadn't done any creative writing courses. I have a degree in history, which is all very factual. And there's no creativity in that respect. And that's frowned upon, really. So I came out completely cold. And I think probably what I say is, a friend of mine picked it up for the first time quite recently. And he said, oh, I'm reading your very first book. I said, oh, did you manage to get to chapter 9 before anything actually happened? And he was like, it's not that bad. And I'm like, well, yeah, you know, because my books now, you have 1-2 chapters and then you're straight into it. Whatever it is, whatever the case is, something is happening immediately. Whereas that first book, I was building a picture and this story and this character and all, but nothing actually happened. I mean, when you look back on it, when you read further into the book, things were there. But certainly it took a long time to get going. And it was a long book. And I think I chopped about 25% out of it before I published it. And it could probably do with a bit more, to be quite honest. So, but no, it's done. I'm not going back re-editing things. No, that's it. It's there. It's, you know, I'm still very proud of it. It sold very well, so people liked it. So I could be very critical of my own work. But yeah, certainly I've evolved in the, I think it's 3 years now since that first book came out. I've written 13 books, I think. Right, 14, I'm not sure, I lose count. But
that's a common thing.
But each one,
as well.
I like to think I'm improving, and it's getting better in the pacing and structure. And you learn that type of thing. You only have to write one or two books, and then you really pick up on structure and pacing and what people like and what they don't. But that said, I think it's very important to stay to what you want to write and don't listen too much to how other people tell you you should write.
Now, it would be remiss of us not to mention, of course, the wonderful associates that we've built up, people who have contributed hugely to the creative success of the company and the workflow. I mean, we do a lot of the grunt work, but we've got a fantastic team of cover designers, of editors in particular, and they've been a massive influence on the way that we work. We learn a lot from when manuscripts come back to us edited. You know, everyone gains, I think.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So I always go through the corrections from the editors, and every time I learn something new. So they're invaluable to us.
They really are. So let's speak to some of our, well, unsung heroes, if you like, starting with our cover design team. Jane Mapp has done many of our designs, as indeed as Jen Butcher. Let's hear from them.
The more research that you do and the more sort of preparation and then even after all that, I tend to go with the first idea that I've had in my head, because I will visualise something in my mind and mull over it for a good couple of weeks before I even start collecting the bits and pieces together. And then I always think, well, do what's been asked for and then throw in a wild card if it's completely different. So I've learnt to sort of trust my instinct a little bit more. I would say that's the first. Because having never done book covers before, it was a completely new.
I try and sort of, I'll not cover my back, but obviously I don't want everything, I don't want it all to be rejected. I want them to sort of feel there's something there. And so I often do quite a few visuals. So I might do, you know, 6 or 8 or something. And I want to be happy with them. I think everything I submit as a visual is a cover, you know, it's a usable cover. It's up to the client whether they choose it or not. I'll never submit something I just think it just doesn't work at all. I mean, it's like a builder trying to build a wall and he knows it's not straight, you know. I wouldn't do that. It's sometimes, especially when it's a new client, I'm trying to put a bit more effort in to impress them.
It's a bit like us when we take on another author. It takes time sometimes to develop a sort of an understanding and communication. And that must be the case when you take on a new client to understand and interpret what they're trying to tell you.
Yeah, I think, you know, a new client might often just send me an email, oh, you know, we've got this job, would you be interested? And, you know, I'll read the brief, and then I often want to chat to them about it as well to fully understand, because there's always a few questions that they probably haven't made clear in the brief. Character descriptions are sometimes to be avoided, but, you know, if they're saying, right, okay, we need a woman on the front, well, okay, can you give us an idea of how old she is, or, you know, tall, or I think you spend a lot of time putting a picture of a woman on the front. Oh no, she's not like that. Yes.
Did I say woman? I meant child.
Yeah, I think what I was trying to say is that I think a lot of the publishers have been doing it for years, you know, the standard man walking away in moody landscape. The more the big publishers do that, the easier it is for the self-published sort of DIY person to copy it, because it's such a standard format. So they end up copying that reasonably successfully, but there's certain bits of how it's executed that they never really understand. Some of it is typography. And I like to think typography is dangerous in the wrong hands. because we're all used to seeing professional typography everywhere. And so when it's poorly executed, it stands out like a sore thumb.
And of course, let's talk to the editors too. We had a very in-depth conversation with Jenny Parrott, who's one of the most experienced crime editors in the country, particularly on the structural side as opposed to the more detailed words. But we've also got a fantastic team of editors who work on the scripts. And I guess the main challenge for them is kind of, how do you break bad news to an author?
Yes, that is a big question, isn't it? You need to be very bold and brave enough to do that.
Writers can only hear what they're ready to hear. So it can sometimes be that they either are maybe not particularly confident, or they haven't quite had enough experience to understand the point you're trying to make. And then you can have, you know, a week later, it can all be a different story. So, yeah. You know, again, you do your best, but I don't think it works with writers trying to make them write a wonderful book. I think you need to encourage and enable them to write that wonderful book.
Helen Gray.
So sometimes people have just said to me, all I want you to do is proofread. So that would be checking for the spelling, punctuation and grammar errors, the presentation errors, if the font it suddenly goes into a different style, different size, and the line spacings, it would be that kind of thing. And then as you build up through the editing, then you're looking at different things, and your feedback is going to get more involved. That's what I find. But I love doing the copy editing and the editing, and being able to have a conversation with the author beyond just saying, oh, there weren't that many mistakes. You know, that's a necessary part of any publication process. But, it doesn't engage me in the same way that editing engages me. And once I've gone through a piece of work, even if it is something that's quite academic in its style, because that's it. It is an academic text, and but what you're looking for then is very different to fiction. But I love then being able to just talk to the author and say that was great, and I, you know, and talk about what I thought was good, and sometimes the bad things as well. that's tricky sometimes.
And finally, as we round up this wonderful year of 2021, with all of its challenges, issues, but also successes, we ought to mention the bookshops, who have battled on through lockdowns, closures, all sorts of supply issues as well to keep going. And we, in recent weeks, have been speaking to a few of them. And, you know, it's really heartwarming just how passionate they are about books.
Absolutely. And just how optimistic they remain, whatever's thrown at them, like you say, pandemics and all sorts. But they just think, OK, I've got to work with this. I've got to be creative. And they do. And I love that about them.
Dan and Leanne Frid of Book Bugs and Dragon Tales in Norwich.
It's quite funny. Sometimes people walk into the shop and we always greet people with a smile and a, oh, you know, if we don't recognise them, have you been in before? And we give them this whole spiel and tour them around the shop. And they wonder what the hell is going on, don't they? Sometimes we get some really strange looks like,
but
is this
so
a shop? Like, in fact, we do get asked a lot, is this a shop? Can we buy the books? You know, it's hilarious. I mean, a lot of booksellers get asked if they can buy the book, if people can buy the books. But we do get asked it a lot. Like, they're not quite sure. It's not, most people get it. But every now and again, it's like, what on earth have I walked into here?
And, because we're so proud of our shop, because it is an extension of our life, our family, that we're so proud, we want to show people around, we want them to feel comfortable. So that is really important to us, that every single person feels welcomed, and we'll leave them alone if they don't look too keen. Yes. We try not to harass them too much.
Yeah,
but it is like, you know, welcome to our safe space. You know, we want you to enjoy it. We're quite like that in our house, although we haven't been in our house for many years. I feel like we just sleep here at the moment. You know, once you've been around once, you're part of the family, and I think that's how we feel about our customers.
Chrissy Lloyd of Medina Books in the Isle of Wight.
So what we like to do is, because we're so small, you know, we're a very small shop really, we like to do something slightly different than what you might get in Waterstones or Amazon. So we, particularly children's, which is one of my section, I'll go for lesser known authors and debut authors and things like that to try and introduce people to, you know, write wonderful, wonderful writers they won't have heard of, to give these other people a chance. We do, you know, we still do stock the top tens, and, you know, we've got Richard Osmond and things, you know, the ones that will sell, but we try to go for things slightly different that, you know, that we've got interest in, that my team, there's three of us in the shop and we're all quite different. And so we're quite passionate about things. So we want to get books in that when people ask for a recommendation, we've either read it or we know the genre, we know the author, and we can really talk passionately about it, because that's what sells the book. As soon as you start, you know, it's the passion that we can put into it that the other place can't, you know, it's soulless. Whereas, you know, that's what a bookshop is about, is it's about the soul and the passion.
Jules Button of the Woodbridge Emporium.
There's no point in competing. You've just got to be different. You've got to be diverse. You've got to offer books that they're not going to get when they're shopping and buying their tins of peas and things like that. You've got to offer different books rather than mainstream books. And also, a lot of the authors that are stocked in like supermarkets and places like that, and, you know, especially the kids' books, you know, the authors are ghostwriters. We won't have them in the shop. I won't have any of those big names.
I think they're probably the same ones. We won't either.
Because why do I want to stock books like that? Why do we want to compete with, you know, the supermarkets and other big bookshops? And, you know, when they're basically selling, I want to sell alternatives. And people will come in going, oh, I want that book by so-and-so, so-and-so, you know, about, you know, I don't know, lots of, you know, I won't mention the books. And I'll say, well, we don't stock that because he's a ghostwriter. And they're all like, what? No. And I go, yeah. But however, we stock this. This writer's really good. The book is fun. It's a quid cheaper, you know, buy it. And it's about educating your customers, because they don't know any different. They're just used to seeing that funny comedian guy writes lovely books for kids, and isn't he so funny and nice? No, actually, he doesn't have a lot to do with them, or they don't have a lot to do with them. Why don't you use, you know, have something better and a nicer read? And so it's hard work, but eventually it does pay off.
So we've used this time in the last few days. I mean, you've had a little bit of time off, which is so rare. a little bit, yeah, away from Hoback stuff, I suppose. You've other projects as well
on
the
go. I've kept other things ticking along, but I haven't been working full pelt by any means. I've been reading for pleasure, which has been absolutely blissful.
Yeah. Well, I've been working on all sorts of bits and bobs, but also taking the chance to enjoy my new cookery toys, my ice cream maker, my stand mixer, and things like that, and sort of refilling the well in a different creative way. But, you know, once New Year's is out of the way, it's back to the grindstone, really, full time.
But I actually do feel quite refreshed now, because I think I got to Christmas and I was exhausted.
You were.
And I was a bit worried that I wouldn't have the energy to, you know, pick it up again after New Year. But I do feel that I have. I think I made the right decision by stepping back a bit. And,
yeah, it was necessary. You were, you know, going grey in many ways, you know, skin wise, your colour
you
had drained.
You did say that to me one
yeah,
day. Yeah,
yeah, you look very drawn. You'd worked so hard, and you know the pressure of Christmas, of course. But anyway, that's now behind us. New Year's, as we launch, this is behind us, and we're looking forward to 2022. So we've got not resolutions, but aims, I suppose. With this podcast, we are still always open to speaking to some wonderful talent. We're going to have an announcement next week of a new author.
We do. We know who he is. Yeah. It's very exciting. Oh, just gave away his gender. Okay, it's a man.
Okay, we have a new male author joining us, but we'll announce that next week. And our guest next week is?
Our guest next week is a writer called Daniel Hurst. And I just came across him by chance on social media. He's had a very, very successful career in just 12 months, I believe, writing. And it's phenomenal, actually, how well he's done. So we want to pick his brains a little bit and how that's happened and hear his story.
We will. And we've got a number of targets lined up already for the year. But we've got some wonderful guests that we want to speak to over the year. We've got a promise from LJ Ross, no less, one of the most successful indie authors in the country, to speak to us. She just had a daughter, so she's a bit busy, but that will come.
We will get to that. I'm looking forward to that very much.
But in terms of aims for next year, I mean, clearly we want to sell more books. That's the number one and be all and end all. And we are going through, you know, extending the relationship with one of our guests, Matt J. Holmes.
Yeah.
Over the next few months, we've got a program of increased marketing for a number of our authors. We're gradually migrating them over, and it's quite a lengthy process in terms of getting all the editorial and the particularly the sort of visual assets ready. So it's not a quick process, but we hope that will be reflected in sales in the first quarter of the year. And we're also encouraged by, you know, when we heard a wonderful podcast featuring Rachel McLean, who's not that far from us in Birmingham.
Irony was we were passing Birmingham when we were
listening. Yeah, absolutely. And she has achieved incredible things, selling several thousand books a day. So, you know, if people can do it, we can. And that's our aim. You know, but wish us well along the way. And there are other aspects of the business that we want to improve. You know, it's been a great chance for us to sort of just restore some of the energy and the batteries and figure out where things go for 2022. And we'll attack it with vigour next year. But, you know, really, for us, it's just been wonderful to share all of this with you. We're also writing a book. We ought to mention that.
Yeah, we should, because we're going to start tomorrow.
We record. That famous phrase, as we record. Yeah, the fact is, we're going to write a book about, we're going to keep a diary of the next year of running Hoback. I mean, in many ways, this podcast has been like that, you know, sort of weekly tot up of what we're getting into. But we're going to get into the real emotional core of what it's like running a business together and trying to achieve the things that we want to achieve for our authors and for our associates and for our readers. So,
but I think the difference, though, with this compared to the podcast is very much a two-way discussion, isn't it? Whereas our book is going to be from our own viewpoints. So there'll be a contrast between how you are going through the process and how I'm going through the process and how we react to it. And so I'm very much looking forward to doing that.
Yeah, so that'll be one for release at the beginning of next year, 2023.
Yes.
So we're looking forward to achieving that. So there are many, many things that we've got planned, and clearly we're building up to getting married at some point in the next couple of years.
I'm a finance.
But it really remains for us to say, look, Happy New Year to all of you. Thank you so much for your time, for your company on the podcast. We do appreciate it. we feel very special and privileged that we've got this opportunity to do it and that so many people enjoy it. And we hope that many more will join next year. But from myself, Adrian Hobart.
And myself, Rebecca Collins, just as the bells bung.
Seem to be Hobart in the next couple of years. It reminds us, the bells, we'll play them out. Let's leave them to say, have a happy and creative week.
You've been listening to the Hobcast from Hobeck Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hobeck online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.